This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The end of the year is traditionally a moment to take stock and look ahead to the challenges of the new year. We're going to take two runs at foreign policy, and we'll begin with a set of issues that dominated 2003. And while predictions are always iffy, it seems a safe bet that Iraq and the Middle East will be major stories next year as well. Later in the program, we'll switch focus to China, Taiwan, North Korea, and the Far East. Next week, South and Central America and Africa. Look over the year ahead. What are the key issues going to be in Iraq, in the Middle East? Human rights, weapons of mass destruction, lagging development, women's rights. Where should the president invest his time and political capital? Where will a crisis force us all to take notice? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. With us now by phone from Houston, Texas, is Edward Djerrigian. He served as ambassador to Israel under President Clinton, was ambassador to Syria under President Reagan and the first President Bush. He's now director of the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Good afternoon.
What would you think would be a reasonable goal for the next 12 months in Iraq?
I think the most important goal is for the United States with its allies to bring security and Iraqi political governance to that country. And by Iraqi political governance, a Iraqi government that is representative of the diverse population of Iraq, which begins to make the political decisions in terms of a constitution, elections, and the sovereignty of the country, and at all costs to avoid inner conflict that could break the country apart into a Kurdish, Shiite, and Sunni areas. That would create a terrible political vacuum in the Middle East and be destabilizing. So I think the most important goal for the next year is to make that political transition under conditions of security and economic development.
The president has spoken broadly of his hopes that a democratic Iraq could be a beacon of human rights, democracy, and capitalism in that region. Can a free Iraq begin to be an engine of reform?
Yes, I believe it can, but the process of getting there is going to be critical. Right now, the country is suffering from economic devastation, political devastation after the collapse of the Ba'athist regime and Saddam Hussein. So basically, the goal of a free, independent, and when we say democratic, we have to be careful as Americans not to think that we may be talking about implanting a Jeffersonian model of democracy in Iraq, but a form of democracy where you have elections, you have representative government, and a sharing of economic, political power, and I would say cultural power because of the diverse population in Iraq. Any movement thought that type of representative government would be quite an accomplishment, which I think would be a positive model for the rest of the region.
We're asking for you to join our conversation about where you think the focus should be in foreign policy in the year 2004. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. And I wonder, Ambassador Djerrigian, as you look ahead towards what might be an Iraqi democracy, as they continue to debate what might be an Afghan democracy in Kabul even as we speak, how do you think Iraqi democracy might fall short of U.S. standards or be different from U.S.?
Well, I think one thing about democracy that is often misunderstood is people focus throughout the world on elections, and they believe that free elections equal democracy. We as Americans know that free elections, while essential, are only one part of democracy and perhaps not the essential part of democracy. The essential part of democracy really is the rule of law, where you have a constitution or a basic law that is adhered to, where you have a distribution of powers between an executive, a legislative, and a judiciary, especially an independent judiciary, so that there is equality before the law. And the other essential element of democracy is the principle of the alternance of power. In brief, if you win an election, you gain political position and power. If you lose the election the next time, you leave. You don't hang on. You don't do a coup d'etat. The alternance of power is key. That's why we were very, when I was in the first Bush administration and the Algerian elections were going to take place in 1992, whereby we supported free elections in Algeria, we were skeptical because the FIS, the Islamic Radical Party, was positioned to win those elections. And we voiced an opinion at that time saying that while we are for one man, one vote, we are not for one man, one vote, one time, saying that we're very suspect of those groups that might come to power under a democratic election system, but only to seize and hold on to power once they're in office. So that's the essential difference that we should aim at. In other words, a government in Iraq that believes in the alternance of power, that puts down a constitution that that guarantees that. That, I think, would be quite an establishment for the whole region.
It's interesting. You just talked about the transfer of power, which is a difficult proposition, not just for democracies, but for every other form of government. The Middle East just absorbed a regime change of the more normal variety in Syria and in Jordan, where the sons of the former rulers took over. In both cases, different systems, same result. Yet there are dangers and opportunities presented by aging leadership today in both Egypt and Saudi Arabia.
That's correct, and in both countries there are in an entirely different setting. In Egypt and in Saudi Arabia, there are movements for reform in both of those countries, and we should be encouraging those reforms, but doing it in an intelligent manner. For example, if you look at the Middle East and most of the countries in the Middle East, they are basically limited democracies at best in some countries, and more often than not, what I call electoral autocracies. Basically, at the top, you have ruling families, ruling groups. At the other end of the spectrum, you have this minority, and I want to stress a minority of Islamic radical extremists. And in the middle, in each country, it's different. You have a ambiguous grouping of what we call civil society, political parties, NGOs. They're nascent in most countries, but you don't have that strong civil society in the middle. So the evolution toward democracy has to be done intelligently. If you push too much on the ruling elites now, what you may end up with is that minority at the other end seizing power. The Islamic radicals, that certainly is not what we want to do. So I think we're in a generational effort to build the middle, build political parties, build civil society, build NGOs, and then gradually urge and encourage these countries to move toward electoral systems. Now, in Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Abdullah is going to make the what they call the Majlis al-Shura, the consultative assembly, more representative, and he has stated elective in the future. In Egypt, there are various movements toward reforming the system. We'll have to see what happens there. But basically, we should be encouraging political and economic reforms in this part of the world because it's in our national interest.
Let's get some callers involved. 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start with Noah, who's with us from Newton, Massachusetts.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a quick question, and I'll try to make it quick.
Okay.
I'm a student, and a lot of what I've learned recently about democracies is that they can be dangerous on a country that's not yet ready for them, such as Germany voting Hitler into power through the ballot box. Now, my question is, how can we don't want to be overhanded here in Iraq, but how can we expect to toughen tone down the rhetoric of, you know, anti-Israel stance and anti-U.S. without it seeming that we are not really giving any power to the Iraqis?
An interesting question. Ambassador Djerijian, this is going to be difficult.
Yes, it's a good question.
All right, thank you.
Thank you for the call, Noah.
It's a good question. Let me try answering it by first saying that, again, we as the United States especially should be encouraging these countries toward political and economic reforms. We can certainly assert our values, our democratic values, our the values we see in a private market economy to create jobs and the best economic opportunities for society. But in translating that in each individual country, we have to be culturally attuned to where that country is coming from, so we don't we are not perceived, as the caller stated, the student stated, as being arrogant and unilateralist and overbearing. We have to prod these countries toward doing the reforms that are necessary. And that means we have to listen and understand the environments we're working under. And I think we have to do that better as Americans, listening and understanding the cultural environments that we have some influence over or are involved in, especially in the Middle East.
Well, some of Noah's question, it seemed to me, was about politics. How do you, the champion of free speech, America, leave Iraq into an election in which anti-Americanism might well be one of the tenets of one of the parties that would be running?
That's right. Well, the anti-Americanism per se of a party may not be the critical factor. The critical factor is getting a political process in place where you have a representative government coming into government power that is representative, again, of Iraq's diverse population of Kurds, Shias, Sunnis, Chaldeans, Syrians, etc. I was very struck in 1991 when we made our contacts in the first Bush administration with the political opposition in Iraq. And we asked them the question, especially the Kurdish leaders, saying, what is your real priority? Is it to have an independent Kurdistan or to be part of a unified Iraq? And the answer was that while in our hearts we Kurds would like to have our own country, we know that if we do gravitate toward that, it will cause a great deal of chaos in the region, because an independent Kurdistan would involve parts of Syria, Turkey, Iran, etc. But what we would like to do as our first priority, and our head tells us that this is the right thing to do, is to participate in a government in Baghdad in which we share with the other groups in political, economic, and cultural power, but that we share equitably. So my answer to the caller's question is that that sharing of political and economic and cultural power by all the groups is the key factor. Not so much whether they are critical of American policies. You know, I just chaired in this summer a congressionally mandated public diplomacy group on U.S. public diplomacy in the Arab and Muslim world. And the question from Congress was, why do they hate us? Well, we saw something that's very, very interesting. The Muslim world, beyond, without any exception, shares American values that they consider to be universal, their values. Liberty, freedom, etc. But they are highly negative and critical of our policies on the Arab-Israeli issue, on Iraq, and on the issues of political and economic governance in their countries, because they see us as supporting regimes that they consider are either dictatorial or autocratic. These are tremendous hurdles that the United States has to overcome in its public diplomacy and in the elaboration and the carrying out of its policies. But we have to face up to those issues. So the caller is right. There is a tension there. But our first goal in Iraq is to get a government in place that is truly representative of the people.
We're speaking with former Ambassador Edward Derigian, now the chairman of the Advisory Commission on Public Diplomacy. Formerly that, he just talked about that report. He's now director of the James Baker III Institute for Public Policy at Rice University in Houston, Texas. We're discussing Iraq and the Middle East, the challenges for 2004. We're going to continue that after a little while, though. We're going to switch focus and talk about the problems in the Far East in 2004, China, Taiwan, North Korea. If you've got questions, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're taking a look at America's foreign policy challenges in 2004. Right now, Iraq and the Middle East, as I said. In a few minutes, we'll turn to another part of the world, China and the Far East. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. Next week, by the way, we'll look at issues in Africa and the Americas. Still with us to talk about Iraq and the Middle East is former Ambassador Edward Djerrigian, who served several presidents, and thanks for still being with us. And let's get some more listeners on the line, and our next caller is Khalid, and Khalid's on the line with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate your show all the time.
Thank you.
Being from Egypt originally, I have some opinions, and I like to agree very strongly with your guest about how most Muslims share the common universal values with the at least declared American values. One of the reasons people have trouble with American policies that seems to be very shifty and evasive. It seems to be dictated by some utilitarian situation. Today, we like this country, so we're going to support this particular set of policies. And I think if I have a wish list for our foreign policy here for the next year as Americans, is to set some gold standards by which we can judge governments regardless of whether they like American policy or not, and set some values for what we will not accept from any countries, being that country, Israel or Egypt or Saudi Arabia, regardless of that country. And I think having...
I'm just trying to clarify, Khaled, are you talking about issues like human rights, for example?
Exactly. Human rights, weapons of mass destruction, reliable democratic systems, clear system of elections, separation of powers between judiciary and legislative. These are the core values in American, some of those locally here are the core values of American democracy, and it would be very hypocritical to have foreign policy whose accepted values shift based on whether we generally like that country or like that dictator or what's the international situation. Are we in war with terrorism or with communists or something else? So something that clear and binding to governments which should be the minimum standard for what we agree on as part of our foreign policy.
Interesting call, Khaled. Thank you very much. Ambassador Djerrigian, a set of objective standards for foreign policy?
Well, I think the values that the United States has, as the caller, Khaled, mentioned, those are shared values certainly with the with most of the world, and certainly what we found in my advisory group's travels and discussions with people from the Muslim majority countries, from Indonesia to Senegal, we basically found that the United States, the goal of the United States, one, is not to be liked. It is not a popularity contest. Public opinion polls are one thing, but really, U.S. policy is based on serving United States national security and overall interests. And therefore, our policies follow that. But if you look at our values, if you look at our basic policies in the Middle East, what are they about, be it a Democratic or a Republican administration? It's conflict resolution in the Arab-Israeli situation, in Kashmir between India and Pakistan, certainly Western Sahara and the Maghreb, et cetera. It's promoting political reforms. It's promoting economic reforms, private capital economies, which we believe in. It's promoting human rights. It's promoting the rights of women. It's for economic development. These are things Americans and any American administration need not shy away from, but to very assertively express what our goals are. Now, sometimes our policies, our specific policies, are viewed as viewed very negatively by people in the region. And I mentioned three main prisms, the Arab-Israeli, the Iraq. I mean, we see ourselves as liberators in Iraq. There are many people in the Middle East who see us, ourselves as occupiers in Iraq, for example. And the Middle East equation, with a lot, many people in the Arab world see us as biased toward Israel. But again, the question arises, when the United States and an American president has stood tall and taken the lead, progress on Arab-Israeli peace has been made, be it under Nixon and Kissinger in the 70s, be it under Jimmy Carter, Cy Vance in 78, 79, and be it under President Bush and Baker, Secretary Baker, in the Madrid Peace Conference. We saw Clinton's efforts, and we see the efforts of the current administration. So the fact is America is critical to a Arab-Israeli peace. So that's a positive factor. How we carry it out is criticized, and that's fair game. But the issue that is more complex is the third one, the issue of political economic governance, the issue of the systems under which the people in the Arab world live. And that is where this is one thing in the 2004, we should be much more intelligently engaging with these countries to start that or to accelerate that process of economic and political reform so that those countries can be more representative politically, economically, and not cause a threat to the international community.
You just cited a long list of diplomatic achievements, and somebody looking from the outside could say, yes, a catalog littered with Nobel Peace Prizes, yet at the end of the day, same old in the Middle East, and continued violence, and seemingly no way out. There seems to be a level of exhaustion at the same time that public opinion polls say, you know, most people would on both sides would seemingly accept, these peace proposals that are out there. But there lacks a mechanism. We seem to have an agreement more or less in hand, but no will to get there.
You're absolutely right, Neil. And the fact we did a poll last month, the Baker Institute and the International Crisis Group in Washington, in the Palestinian territories and in Israel, and we basically said, would you vote for or against the following overall guidelines
and
settlement?
Just for brevity's sake, we'll say it's the Geneva Accord.
Geneva Accord, exactly. And we got 53% approval in Israel and 56% in the Palestinian territories.
And as heartening
as
that is.
And therefore, you know, we had a wonderful Israeli novelist, Amos Oz, here. He's characterized as a peacenik. But he said, the problem we have, we Israelis and the Palestinians, is that we are the patients and we're crying for surgery, but our doctors are refusing to perform it.
Well,
it takes political will. It takes political will on the leadership, on the Palestinian side, the Israeli side, the American side, the international community. The overall end game of an Israeli-Palestinian settlement is quite clear. It has been clear certainly for many years, certainly since the Madrid Peace Conference, where we established the guiding principles for peace. It's clear. It takes political will to get there, and that's what has been lacking.
And political will to confront those very substantial minorities who would be, some of them, diehards opposed to it.
Exactly, but that's where you need leadership. That's where political will comes in.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, and with at least some hope that the doctors will get to the operating room in the Middle East in 2004. Edward Djerejian, no matter what happens, we wish you the very best of New Year's.
Thank you, and to you too, Neil.
Ed Djerejian is a ambassador, served as an ambassador in many administrations, both Republican and Democrat. He's now director of the James Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice University. He spoke to us from his home in Houston, Texas, and we turn now from the Middle East to Asia. The rest of the hour, we'll discuss what will be, not quite the rest of the hour, but next few minutes we'll discuss what will be at the top of President Bush's foreign policy agenda in regards to China, Taiwan, and North Korea. Joining us from the studios of member station WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, is Kenneth Lieberthal, Senior Director for Asia on the National Security Council under President Clinton, who now teaches political science at the University of Michigan. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
And let us begin with the seemingly developing crisis involving Taiwan, which presents a very difficult and volatile situation both for Beijing and for Washington. Explain some of the tension there as we head into the new year.
Yeah, you're right. This is a very tough issue. In Taiwan, there's a presidential election coming up in March of this coming year. The leading contender for the Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, is a man by the name of Chen Shui-bian. He's the incumbent president. He is running on record that in economic terms and in terms of political governance over the last few years of his incumbency is not very strong. So he's chosen to try to create tensions across the Taiwan Strait as a vehicle for nudging Beijing into a harsh response, hoping that that response will then boost his vote at the polls as someone who can stand up to Beijing. In the process, he's creating escalating tensions at a time when the U.S. and China both don't want to see tensions rise across the strait. U.S. is focused on Iraq, on North Korea, and other issues. China is happy to see this situation unfold in a gradual and peaceful fashion. But Chum, largely for electoral purposes, is really pushing the envelope in a way that I think raises risk for everyone involved.
Well, who does then the United States stand with, those corporate communists in Beijing or those rambunctious Democrats in Taipei?
Well, the answer is both. The U.S. has very long-standing ties to the people of Taiwan. Those are ties that we are not going to move away from anytime soon. But our commitment to Taiwan really is to nurture Taiwan's democracy, to try to maintain conditions where Taiwan business people can pursue a vibrant economy, and where Taiwan can enjoy basic security. What's happening in Taiwan now is Chung and his political followers are trying to add to Taiwan's democracy, prosperity, and security Taiwan independence, in other words, self-determination. That is where the U.S. has not historically had a commitment. Our commitment has simply been to have cross-strait issues resolved peacefully. And on the mainland side, they have said essentially they want to resolve this thing peacefully, but if Taiwan should declare independence, then they will use force to cut that off. So we're seeing a situation move out of a framework that's maintained a basic kind of stability in the area for decades. We're sitting by very much wanting and needing cooperative ties with China on a whole array of issues, and at the same time wanting to maintain good ties with Taiwan, but not wanting to see the Taiwan leadership add independence to the list of attributes of that place.
It's interesting that if you go through the big economic issues in terms of China and the Far East, it's not the word Japan that comes up quite as much as the word China does.
Well, China has had the fastest rate of growth of any major economy in the world over the past quarter century, averaging nearly 10% per year. By now, its economy is big enough that it will, this coming year, become America's third largest trading partner. It has attracted more foreign direct investment over the past year than any other country in the world, including the United States. And it's becoming, in many ways, a manufacturing center for the entire world. So while Japan's economy is still at least four times the size of China's economy, Japan's economy is basically stagnant. China's economy is very much on the move, and therefore people are really focused on the changes that Chinese growth is making in the global economy.
And the changes that are going about in China itself. A new generation of leadership has emerged in Beijing.
Very much so. In fact, U.S. policy has long been based on the notion that if you can get China integrated into the global economy, move China into the information revolution, that this will help to nurture kinds of changes in China that over the long run are good for the people of China and good for everyone else too. If not a full democracy anytime soon, at least moving from the kind of a totalitarian system that they had several decades ago to a very loose authoritarian kind of political regime, hopefully in the future moving to a democratic system with a lot more freedom of speech, a lot more freedom of choice of individuals, and a lot higher standard of living for the people of that country. And I think, frankly, that basic American approach has been the right one, and the evidence of success is everywhere that you look around China.
We're speaking with Kenneth Lieberthal. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Jean-Marc, who joins us from Palo Alto, California.
Yeah, hi, good morning. I think, Neil, also that you forgot to mention that Mr. Lieberthal is a very renowned sinologist, so I really am pleased to have a chance to hear him speak on your show.
And did you have a question for him?
Yes, I do. I would like to get Mr. Lieberthal's opinion as to who actually is in charge of foreign policy making in China on the Taiwan issue, especially given some of the polemics that PLA officers have been publishing recently about willing to sacrifice the Olympics and so on about Taiwan.
And PLA, of course, is the People's Liberation Army.
That's correct.
You raise a very important question. China has just been through a political succession. It's the first peaceful succession that has occurred when scheduled since the 1800s in China. So it really marks a significant stage in its political development. But at the same time, the new leadership has not fully consolidated its power. And one of the key dimensions of this is that the former president and former head of the Chinese Communist Party, Jiang Zemin, has retained direct control over the Chinese military. So Jiang no longer serves on the Standing Committee of the Politburo, but he does have the operational command of the military. This is not to suggest that the military is off in a totally independent direction under Jiang. That is not the case. But it is the case that I think this new leadership has not yet fully gelled to where you can say that the top two people, the premier and the president, Hu Jintao and Wang Jiabao, have tight control over the foreign policy system. I think there's a lot of negotiating that's going on now. That's one of the reasons why it's particularly unfortunate that this cross-strait tension is increasing now, because it may be at a time when domestically in China it's especially difficult to keep that kind of issue under tight control of people who want to take a more moderate and long-term approach to it.
Jean-Marc, thanks very much for the question.
Thank you. May I ask one more question?
We're really running out of time, and I've got to get to North Korea.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Bye.
All right. There's North Korea. The next set of talks is scheduled to come up fairly soon in January, I think. The six-party talks is North Korea, is, of course, going to be taking advantage of U.S. preoccupation elsewhere in the world. Is this going to be the concerns over North Korea's nuclear weapons program, are they going to be sufficiently addressed, do you think, in 2004?
Well, I think if they are, it's going to take the entire year to do it. I don't think these talks are going to end anytime soon. It's a good thing that talks are continuing, that the six-party talks will now reconvene under Chinese aegis. But the reality is that we have not yet agreed with the North Koreans on a serious negotiating roadmap to get to a solution to this crisis. The talks, therefore, are likely to last, I believe, until after our election next November. And so to me, the priority for the United States at this point ought to be to get North Korea's verifiable agreement to a freeze on its current nuclear program. While these talks are going on, North Korea continues to develop nuclear materials, and we presume to fashion them into nuclear weapons. And I think we have a very, very strong interest in not seeing North Korea's nuclear arsenal grow while we're sitting at a negotiating table for months or even for more than a year at a time.
Kenneth Lieberthal, I'm afraid that's all the time we have. We appreciate your being willing to speak with us today, though.
Well, thank you.
Kenneth Lieberthal was Senior Director for Asia on the National Security Council under President Clinton. He now teaches political science at the University of Michigan. He joined us from the studios of member station WUOM in Ann Arbor. Coming up after the break, we're going to focus on the new visit program. Many foreigners arriving in the United States will soon be subject to photography and fingerprinting. Also, more air marshals, including requests for international air marshals. That is, if a British plane were to be crossing U.S. territory to get to Mexico, the U.S. wants an air marshal aboard that flight. We'll talk about that after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.